So this is continuing with Peter Scheuer on 27 August 76.
Just as the last dissertate ran out, I was saying that though I had some tremendous scientific arguments with Martin Ryle, I've been consistently impressed by his generosity, and that he's never, this has never been reflected in anything personal or in anything in things he's done for me.
Yeah.
On quite a different subject, something which occurred to me in after we'd finished this morning, that perhaps I should say, at the risk of repeating what other people have told you, that in the early days there was not only resistance to the sorts of measurements that we made because of anything to do with the confusion problem or the angular diameter problem. There's a much more basic hang-up, so far particularly as the optical astronomers were concerned, which is that they had virtually no experience or understanding of interferometers.
Mm-hmm.
And the standard argument was, well, an interferometer only gives you a few Fourier components. It doesn't give you an image, and you can't really deduce anything from some Fourier from just a few Fourier components.
Mm-hmm.
So an interferometer doesn't really tell you anything one can believe. And it took a very long time before any optical astronomers would really take any notice, would take any serious notice of anything that wasn't produced with something that looked like a telescope. They could understand what a paraboloid was,
yeah.
But an interferometer, again, was the unknown devil.
Right. Now, this comment, I would presume, goes all the way back to the late 40s that you're talking.
Well, it goes on into the 50s, I think, yeah. Quite comfortably.
But I mean, it's not just 2C you're talking about.
I became a research student in 51.
Yeah.
So it certainly went on into the mid-50s.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe somewhat beyond.
Would you care to name any names?
No, I wouldn't care to name any names. Partly because I can't remember them rightly, but it was very much in one's consciousness.
Yeah.
And it's something that by now I think one tends to forget because everybody's familiar with
parameters.
And it wasn't merely old fuddy-duddies. It was some very bright people mm-hmm. who had this attitude.
Well,
and even some people in radio astronomy who were not concerned with continuum measurements.
Right, because in the earliest days of radio astronomy, the 30s and 40s, there was a natural reluctance by optical astronomers to understand what this all was all about, all these wires and radio technology. But they got over that to some extent. But what you're saying is that only if it was somehow nicely analogous to optical astronomy, namely with a dish.
Yes.
And they still had conceptual problems with the power of interferometric technique and so forth.
Yes.
Yeah. Just to finish up, we had not actually talked about the Paris Symposium as a meeting, I don't think.
No.
I'd be interested in you were there. It was a rather significant meeting, as I see it. It's what your comments would be about that meeting.
Well, what do you want me to comment on?
Well, the atmosphere of it, whether you learned anything from it, or...
We had a session in which there was a rather tense debate about the source count business, and at the end of which I felt, I think, somewhat resentful at not having been allowed to reply to various criticisms, which were just allowed to stand. The other remark that I remember was Fred Hoyle's remark that the main thing that had happened since the last meeting was that you referred to, had been the hardening of opinion in favor of the synchrotron emission process.
Right, right.
Implying that it had become established simply because nobody thought of anything else.
Yeah, and one could almost still say that today.
Yes.
I'm always amazed at how synchrotron seems to pop up everywhere because it's so useful, but I always wonder if that's really what's going on. Were you involved at all in synchrotron theory? Not at that stage.
No, I really got interested in synchrotron theory theory somewhat later.
But as an explanation, for instance, for the galactic background as opposed to the integral of millions of radio stars, when would you say that this really became to be accepted? Was it between 55 and 58?
I find that very hard to remember. It was a gradual process, I think. There was a school of thought which held that the background was really the superposition of lots of supernova remnants, which may in some roundabout devious sense be true. It may be that all the cosmic ray particles are made in supernova remnants, but which I don't think stands up as a taken literally. And the question of whether it was continuum. Of course, one of the interesting things that happened that I wasn't particularly concerned with, except right at the beginning, was the existence of a galactic halo, which was really John Baldwin's vision. And he proposed this, was seized on by the cosmic ray astronomers, and then the radio astronomers took it away again. The cosmic ray astronomers haven't let it go yet.
Yeah.
Still a matter of lively debate from time to time, how many galaxies have such things.
How did you view the Russian synchrotron theory work as a theorist yourself? Did you have
I wasn't a theorist in those days.
You
really.
Were? Oh, I see.
No, I was an honest observer.
Well, of course, P&D is, I suppose, theory, analysis or something.
Oh, yes, all right.
Yeah. I see, so you weren't directly involved. I'm interested in how that became accepted in the West, so forth.
I think gradually.
Yeah.
As people learned about it, I mean, it's quite a sizable. It's quite a nasty bit of analysis to work one's way through. One has to be fairly convinced that it's relevant before one goes to that trouble.
Yeah. At the Paris Symposium, did you come back to Cambridge with any new ideas as to what direction you should take in your own research?
No, I think the directions that one wanted to take in one's own research were fairly fairly clear. There were a large number of very obvious questions, and what I was particularly interested in getting into was the measurement of angular diameters, lots of them, partly, of course, for their own sake, because this was clearly the way to go, and partly, and which is the way that Cambridge, a lot of Cambridge work has gone since.
Mm-hmm.
Synthesis, which by the way, in principle was quite clear in the mid-50s. It was a matter of building the instruments and developing the techniques.
Right.
And also, of course, it was really made practicable by the advances in computers.
Right.
It would have been very difficult to do in any other way.
Yeah, I think Ryle has traced it in his notebook back to 54 or something,
something
super synthesis. So.
Yes.
But what the angular diameters you were saying?
Yes, the angular diameters.
And I guess you were interested in that.
Partly for their own sake, but of course partly to clear up this question of whether they accounted for the lack of bright sources.
And so, did you get involved in that in the year after the Paris Symposium?
Not immediately afterwards. I did later in one of the scientifically sadder plots of my. Life. I went to Australia for 3 years, Sydney, 60 to 63, and I did get an engine going for measuring angular diameters of lots of sources. But the problems with calibration and analysis were quite difficult, and the amount of material that was produced, the number of sources that turned up on the record, was huge, and of course there wasn't digital data processing in those days. And so I'm afraid that all got lost in limbo.
Never was published. Now, could you tell me a little bit about what this engine was you referred
to? Oh, well, this was quite fun in its own way. the thing that I used was a kind of antenna system which we called barley sugars, which were invented by... who invented them? Was it Tony Turtle? Or John Baldwin, or both between them, but I'm not sure. You'd have to check up on that.
Okay.
Which consisted of a transmission line, which you wound into a helix.
Yeah.
So you got a little bit of quadrupole radiation. See.
Right.
And in fact, one could what's it now called? Apodize, I think is the trendy word for it. One's aerialized one liked by widening
the
thing as it went out to compensate in part for the loss of energy. You consider it as a radiating mechanism as you go towards the ends. And the beauty of this is that it's exceedingly cheap to make rather a lot of it, and you can roll it up and hang it up somewhere else on a sort of washing line.
Right.
And we made quite a lot of this stuff.
I see. And where does this name come from?
Quite large cane. Well, because barley sugars often have a twisted pattern through the middle, you know, rock.
I don't know what barley sugar is.
Ah, well, do you know what rock means?
Rock candy?
Rock candy,
yeah,
let
what
it through,
it
you know.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, there's a kind of it which is just
twisted.
It's twisted,
I see. and so you, what did you actually make then?
Well, we made a lot of this stuff using the East West Arm of the Mills Cross as one end of the interferometer, and taking this rolled up thing out to various outstations.
I see.
So I did have a go at this, but it didn't come to anything, and of course later on there was no point because of the synthesis methods.
Yeah.
Obviously far more powerful.
What was it that really was the problem? I mean,
oh, the problem was that there was too much data to process manually, really.
You got overtaken by the synthesis methods, would you say?
Well, it's partly that. Partly that I moved back to Cambridge before it had all been sewn up and the analysis completed.
Now, you also worked on the Parkes dish, I believe, while you were there.
I worked a very little bit on the Parkes dish, really mainly for the fun of using it.
But wasn't it relevant to this?
It was great fun because one could actually push the button.
Yeah. wasn't this relevant, though, to the whole source count and confusion business? Was that what you were trying to straighten out?
No. The thing which I did with the Parkes dish was to look at some of the sources which appeared in the Mills catalogue as extended sources.
Oh, yes.
As large extended sources.
I knew it was part of the controversy.
And to see whether they were in fact blends of smaller sources or whether they really were extended things.
And the result was?
The result was fairly mixed. The difficulty, on the whole, I think they broke up into blends of weaker sources. But the difficulty, of course, is that to do this job with the Parkes dish, you had to work at 21 centimeters. And to compare that directly with observations at 85 megahertz is really a rather large leap, so I
right.
didn't say anything absolutely conclusive, but my impression is that those extended sources have faded away, and I don't think we've got any more of them.
You had to work at 21 to get enough angular resolution?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the only sort of receiver that
you perhaps it says in your paper, but I'm not familiar with it. Was there a certain fraction of these that were galactic background features, so to speak, as well as blends?
Oh, low latitude ones certainly partly were, yes. Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that there's some near the galactic plane, but the high latitude ones, I think, are on the whole.
But it's also rather interesting.
There are, of course, some big sources. They do exist.
Yeah.
Very few.
It's rather interesting that you went to sort of the camp of the enemy in 1960. How did that come about?
Oh, because Bernie Mills wrote, or perhaps it was Pawsey, and said we'd like to come over for
a year. I see. So things had settled down enough.
I don't know whether things had settled down. I think the point was that these disputes don't have as much personal animosity as people often think, in spite of the very heated and sometimes quite bitter scientific disputes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that amazed me when I got to Australia and met Bernie Mills personally, and he was extremely friendly, he came down to the ship to meet me, was that in some ways they have a great deal in common.
Well, that
in their,
could be a
in
part
their,
of
in
it.
Their,
you
in
know.
Their, in their, well, there.
Their style.
Their style, the sort of things they're interested in, their politics.
Mm-hmm. as you know, when two people do have very similar things, there sometimes is a sort of a grating there.
But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very tremendously.
Yeah. What was the other question? Oh, yes, Mills, talking to him a couple of days ago, was telling me about the operational definition of what he called a source, namely anything that had a bump on it, whether it was extended or not.
Yeah.
And he was trying to make a contrast between this sort of thing and the Cambridge thing and the 2C anyway, there was an operational definition also, I would say. Anything that fit the overall pattern, the envelope looked right.
That's much the same, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it is.
All that happens is that in one case you have fringes within the bump.
Right. There was some difference that he was pointing out, and I wanted to get your opinion. I guess the point was, I asked him, well, why didn't you throw out the extended ones for fear that they might be blends and such? And he thought that would be dangerous to some degree. And I still don't quite see why it wouldn't be a safer way to proceed from his point of view.
Well, then you need an impersonal way of drawing the line between what is a source that is worthy of being included in an extended source that's worthy of being thrown out.
But there's always that.
Even more difficult.
Right, but there's always that, because even if you take all extended ones, there's some signal level at which you decide that it's not a real.
Well, this is a problem which was aired again at the IAU symposium number whatever it was last week in Cambridge.
74. Yeah.
People were saying, well, maybe there are lurking quite a lot more sources like 3C236, which have vast outer components. There are probably some more of these that we don't know about yet.
So yeah.
Even this problem isn't there.
It stays with us. And of course, the controversy
The converse one is also there, and is very much there for the faint sources. When you count two dots as being parts of a double, and when do you count them as two separate sources? And there are cases where this has practical consequences that we know about now. 3C225, for example, is really two unrelated, is now thought to be two unrelated sources.
Yeah.
And so 3C402. I think it's 402, which is broken up into two of these low-powered sources, each with its own associated.
Well, along the same line, it seems to me that meeting pointed out that the entire log n, log s thing, how you interpret or whether you should even bother to interpret it, is still an extremely active issue after 20 years. Would you agree with that?
I doubt whether it's as active as it was myself, but this may merely reflect the fact that my interests shifted away from it.
Well,
that is to say, there is now. It was a very gentlemanly meeting last week, and there were various long discussions of marginal results about anisotropies and so on and so forth. But the basic source counts seem to be agreed. The basic data seem to be agreed.
Yeah.
How one interprets it is not in very much doubt. And after all, the arguments about whether the source counts show evolution or not.
Yeah.
It's become a bit more academic, because anybody who doesn't care to believe the source counts will still very likely believe that the microwave background indicates that we are in an evolving universe.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, there's no plausible explanation for it in steady state.
But what I was trying to say is that it still is controversy as to whether log n, log s can be used as additional evidence for an evolving universe. Would you think that's a fair statement?
Marginally. I wouldn't have thought that there was all that much dispute about it. Because even if you can find enough sources in one way or another to fill up the gap of the high flux densities,
right,
you still run into trouble, because we now know that a lot of these things have large redshifts. And if you believe that large redshifts mean cosmology, then the source counts ought to bend down rather quickly. So it's just not enough.
I see what you're saying.
And not only that, even if you don't allow, if you don't admit the redshifts are cosmological, you still have a good deal of trouble in with the old argument that appeared in Martin Rao's Beckerian lecture in 58. You get too much background if all these redshifts are ignored and you put them all immediately around us.
Yeah, indeed. Well, in closing, I'd be interested in your comments about the nature of working in the Cambridge group. You've been there now 25 years or so. It seems to me there's an incredible unity of the group, and I'd be interested in how you think that has come about.
It's come about very largely, I suppose, because of Martin Ryle, because he is a great enthusiast, and because he has his feet very firmly on the ground, because he has not become an administrator and committee man, because he is very intimately concerned with the details of the hardware and with everything that goes on in his group.
Yeah.
That's a very important thing. I'm amazed that it works, because one of the things that I find very disturbing, considered in the abstract, you know, that I would consider terrible, somebody just told me about it, is that the staff members of the Cambridge group, I think, are all but one people with Cambridge PhDs.
Right.
All gone through the system.
Right.
So it looks a terribly inbred collection.
Yeah.
And if I just heard that in the abstract, I would say such a group must have decayed.
Mm-hmm.
It must have run short of ideas. It must run short of steam. And it amazes me that it hasn't.
Yeah. I made exactly the same comment to John Shakeshaft last night. I found it amazing, because I know several of the cases where one can point to that where that's happened.
Yeah.
Sort of stasis has set in.
I think the reason for it, the reason for people saying that, is that Cambridge is a very pleasant place to work in. It's a very good place to be in for astronomy now, because there is a variety of different things going on.
Yeah.
There's a very strong group in the Institute across the road, and furthermore, with a continual flow of visitors from foreign parts. So that probably plays a part in.
Yeah. Any other comments in closing that you, looking back over the development of radio astronomy, that you'd like to have?
I think nothing that can be accommodated in, one turn of the tape.
In 1 minute. Okay, thank you very much. That ends the interview with Peter Scheuer on 27th August 1976, and this is the end of the tape.